This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. In the early 20th century, physicist Albert Einstein had quickly become the face of modern science. Along the road to fame, though, the once shy patent clerk had made some powerful enemies, including Nobel Prize winner Philip Leonard. Leonard had studied under some of the greatest scientific minds of the era in many of Europe's big scientific centers. Einstein published many important articles that made a case for the field of theoretical physics, including his special theory of relativity. Leonard saw Einstein's science as impractical and downright wrong. Philip Leonard would spend the rest of his life trying to wreck Einstein's reputation, and it's not a story a lot of people know about. Bruce Hillman was surprised when he heard it, so he did some research and he wrote a book, and it's called The Man Who Stalked Einstein. Bruce Hillman has several events this month, including a reading at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh on Thursday, June 25th. You can find out more about that at our website, but first we welcome Bruce Hillman. Welcome to the State of Things.
Very nice to be here. Thank you, Frank.
Tell us a little bit about this, about Philip Leonard. We think we know a lot about Einstein, but Philip Leonard, not so much. Who was he?
Well, I think there's a lesson that we remember Einstein so well, and yet Philip Leonard has pretty much escaped attention. He was the 1905 Nobel laureate in physics, only the fifth Nobel Prize in physics ever awarded. And really, he had a normal-seeming life for quite a while, but all the while, I think he was seething beneath the surface. It became evident in his attacks on first Wilhelm Röntgen, who discovered the X-ray, and later on Einstein and other scientists as well.
Now, we should talk about his physics and some of his accomplishments. I mean, Einstein will be forever associated. His science is something that led to the bomb, among other things, a pretty destructive instrument. And yet, Leonard... perhaps a more destructive invention, the cathode tube that leads to television.
Yes, he didn't exactly invent the cathode ray tube. Many people were playing with the cathode ray tube before his time, but he made an essential improvement on it. What he did was to make the glass thin out and finally disappear and covered it with a thin coat of aluminum. And this allowed the X-rays and the cathode rays to be observed outside the tube itself and actually led, at least in Leonard's mind, to Röntgen discovering the X-ray. He later claimed that he, in fact, had been the discoverer, although the rest of the world didn't agree. And in his Nobel lecture in 1905, he said something to the effect that, well, Röntgen had only been the midwife of the X-ray, who'd had the pleasure of announcing the birth, but had nothing more to do with the conception than the stork, and he claimed to be the true mother of the X-ray.
So we already have a kind of rough profile of a man who is very jealous, who is, in many ways, and this is a very young profession too. The profession of physics itself, as a academic study, is new and emerging very, very quickly.
There was physics, but it was almost purely experimental physics, dating back to Newton, Kepler, Copernicus. These were Leonard's heroes. They were individuals who worked their way experiment by experiment to develop truths about the universe. And what really galled Leonard about Einstein was he was the opposite. He was a theoretical physicist, and this was brand new at the time. Theoretical physicists work really in the opposite direction. They look at what's known about the universe, and they put it together in a deductive way, saying this is how the universe works. And then either they or others conduct the experiments that prove them right or wrong. And this is exactly how it worked for Einstein.
So now we're really starting to set up the elements here, the dynamics. We have a man who appears to be somewhat insecure and jealous in his personality. He has a legitimate scientific argument, and it was at the time, whether or not this practical physics had to be the way forward or theoretical physics even had a place in the academy. And now we enter and include the cultural overlay, the fact that Einstein was a Jew, they were in Germany at the time, and anti-Semitism is on the rise.
Yes, that's very important to recognize. It was immediately after the war, the Great War, the war to end all wars. Of course, that didn't turn out quite like that. And Einstein by this time was very well known, very well reputed. He'd been recruited by the dean of German science, Max Planck, to come to Berlin. He was given all kinds of special considerations that nobody else could have demanded. And Lenard thought the whole thing was a crock. He thought that, in fact, Einstein was a charlatan. And when he finally got to being outwardly anti-Semitic, he simply referred to the whole thing as a cynical Jewish fraud. But if you go to 1919, the end of the war, that's when the war ended, and Germany was put under terrible, terrible pressure by the victorious Allies, and horrific inflation began. Lenard was always a nationalist, but now he became ultra-nationalistic, and it coincided almost exactly the time that Hitler took over the Nazi Party. That was an accident. He was sent there to be a spy by the German government. He was still in the army, and he drank the Kool-Aid and instead became the leader of this fumbling little minority party that grew into being the Nazi Party.
How do Lenard and Hitler come together?
Well, it was a natural occurrence. In many ways, Hitler needed Lenard. Even well into the development of the Nazi Party, 5, 6, 7, 8 years in, it was thought to be very radical by many of the more moderate individuals in Germany. So he needed well-known people like Lenard, and Lenard came with something special. He came with an anger for Albert Einstein. Hitler was a very shrewd man. He realized it was hard to demonize a whole people. He needed some specific individuals that could be demonized and could be held out as representatives of the whole. And Einstein was perfect. He was a liberal. He was internationalist. He was a pacifist. He was everything that Hitler didn't want Germany to be and everything Lenard was against.
And in this play of personalities on the political stage, Lenard and Einstein actually had some titanic battles, one in particular, that were very public events.
That's correct. It really occurred in 1920, where I would say it went from a debate over science to being great personal conflict, where science was pretty much forgotten. The first instance was in September of that year in Berlin at the Philharmonic Opera, the Philharmonic building in downtown Berlin, where Lenard had arranged, he sort of was in the shadows in the background, but arranged for a series of lectures to be presented that would show up Einstein for what Lenard believed he was, this fraud. And Einstein actually attended the first of these and laughed through it, his stepdaughter sitting next to him. But when it was over, he realized that he had to respond, and he responded very publicly in the newspapers. And he pointed out Lenard as being the man behind it. And, of course, Lenard had taken these great pains not to be seen. When he returned from vacation in the Black Forest, he was angered terribly. And this is how the battle began.
How did it continue in terms of Lenard's ongoing efforts, both in print and publicly in these kinds of fora, to take down Einstein's reputation? Yeah.
So the anti-Semitism at this point was really concealed, but it wasn't concealed so much that people couldn't see what a great deal of it was about. At the end of the lecture at the Philharmonic, Einstein, in his newspaper response, challenged anyone to debate him on the theory of relativity. And just a month and a half, 2 months later, there was the first big meeting of German scientists since the war. And this was a very important meeting because, in fact, no other country would allow Germans to participate in their scientific endeavors. There was such anger and retribution for what Germany had done. So this was the only big science they were going to be involved in. The last session of the entire meeting was set up in a bathhouse. It was in a town called Bad Nauheim, famous for its healing waters. The last session was set up in a bathhouse, and sure enough, Lenard was waiting in the weeds for Einstein. It was supposed to be a general debate, but it really became mano a mano, Lenard and Einstein. And it started on science, but it very rapidly degenerated. It was much more like two men arguing over a favorite toy. Lenard ran off as soon as the thing was over. Einstein tried to talk to him in the cloakroom, but Lenard would have nothing of it. He said, "It's too late," and went to the train. And that was when his true radicalization began.
the theoretical physics smackdown, but an important turning point in this whole story. So we understand now how politics and science and emerging science are coming together, and now we're learning more about the personalities. Let's take a look at the scientific world. How seriously did they take Lenard's charges, especially early on?
Well, very. I would say that this was probably the hottest conflict was in Germany, this was a conflict throughout Europe. There's a chapter in the book about the Nobel Prize and why it took Einstein 11 years of nominations, 63 nominations in all, when clearly he was the most famous physicist in the world, not just because of his ideas, but because of the man. He was a great wit. He was a humorist. The ladies loved him, and this could get him in trouble from time to time. But the Nobel Committee was comprised entirely or almost entirely of experimentalists. They were known as the Little Popes of Uppsala because they held such incredible sway over the Nobel Prize for Physics. And it really took the deaths of a couple of the small popes before Einstein was awarded the prize.
And just to illustrate how important and serious a debate this was between the theoretical and the experimental scientist, I mean, you even have a wonderful part of a conversation between Heisenberg and Einstein. I mean, Heisenberg whose physics is rooted in and fundamental to theoretical physics, questioning Einstein about whether or not you could ever move forward with this kind of physics.
Well, it's true, but at the same time, Heisenberg was probably by 1935 or so the sole remaining proponent of Einstein remaining in Germany.
Though that's an important point, because by 1933, when the Nazis do take over, we start to see the purges in the academy, right?
That's exactly right. Lenard, with his younger colleague Johannes Stark, were really the point men in getting rid of the Jews out of all of the German universities. And this is why the subtitle of the book, How Nazi Scientist Philipp Lenard Changed the Course of History. He did that by basically cleansing the universities of its best scientists. And where did they go? Where could they go? If they could get out at all, the very best of them went to America, to Great Britain, to Russia, the very enemies that Germany was going to have to face, and to their detriment.
Yeah, quite luckily, that really delayed the Nazi project of developing nuclear weapons, atomic weapons, and just long enough, I guess.
Well, there was this. Lenard published a book in 1933, just as Hitler was ascending to power, called Deutsche Physik. And Deutsche Physik was intended to be all of his lectures, the lectures he'd gotten together over the years where he was the chairman, the dean of physics, which was at Heidelberg, University of Heidelberg. But it starts out with a philosophical rant, a rant about Aryan superiority and how the Jews were inferior and how the Jews took over science and how it had to be stopped by him. It's almost impossible to read it, actually.
It's surprising, given the success he had with the Nazi regime and Hitler, that he went throughout his life and even after thinking he didn't get enough credit for what he considered his brave stand against Einstein.
Isn't that something? Well, he always felt he didn't get enough credit, regardless, for anything we're talking about. He actually kept, and this is an uncommon thing, what he called a false book. And in that book, he wrote down everything that he thought had been stolen from him, intellectual ideas that had been stolen from him, people who had not given him the credit he thought he deserved. It's a demonstration of the paranoid narcissism that really characterized his personality.
It's an extraordinary story. How did you come to learn about it?
Yeah, totally by accident. This is radio and people can't see me, but I'm older than your basic first authorship. I've had a full career as a physician, and it was about 8 years ago when a group of women at my age or older who took me in and started critiquing my writing, and they helped me enormously. This was in Charlottesville, Virginia. And from there, I decided, well, I'd write a book. And what I wrote was a book called The Sorcerer's Apprentice that talks out for lay people how medical imaging works. I'm a radiologist.
I was going to say, Disney bought that, and now you're a millionaire.
If only.
Sorry.
I'm lucky he didn't sue me, more likely.
Go ahead.
But at any rate, I thought, well, the next thing I should do would be to write a book unrelated to medicine. And I was searching around for an idea. I'd actually written a novel, which is still unpublished, couldn't find an agent to handle it. And I went over to Cambridge, and I was giving a lecture. And I didn't want to just go for this one lecture, so I added on 4 or 5 days. I took the train 12 hours north of Aberdeen and went out on the golf course named Cruden Bay. I love to play golf, and this is like playing on the moon. And I met 2 Canadian brothers. They were assigned to play with me. They told me this amazing story about their father, who had been a general during World War II in the Canadian Army and assigned to the New Mexico test sites, the atomic test sites. And the way they told it, it's hard to believe, but they said, well, the only equipment they gave him was a chaise lounge and a pair of very dark glasses, and they said, watch this. And the guy apparently was very healthy till age 70, and then suddenly got this rapidly progressive neurological disease and died within a year. And they wanted to know, was it the radiation? Now, radiologists doesn't deal with that kind of radiation. It's tiny doses. So I started reading, and way out of place, I can't even figure how it got in the pile, was an article, a 1946 article, about how this interrogation of Philip Lennard had gone by a man soon to become a radiologist. And it was all about Rentgen and how Rentgen had stolen what he had done.
The inventor of the X-ray.
The inventor of the X-ray. Yeah. And so I started reading some more, and it wasn't Rentgen. That was a little sidebar. It was Einstein that he'd had the real beef against and who he chased for a lifetime, basically.
It's a remarkable story. Thank you so much for telling and sharing the story with us, Dr. Bruce Hillman. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Bruce Hillman is the author of The Man Who Stalked Einstein, How Nazi Scientist Philip Lennard Changed the Course of History. He's going to be reading throughout the month of June, including Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh on the 25th at 7 o'clock. And you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Program produced by Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Hadi Mawagdi, and Will Michaels. Robin Copley is our technical director. Andrew Tai is our intern. Brent Wolf is WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.